Well, thank you for that lovely introduction by Bessa. And can I just say, Saha, what outstanding work you are doing. Really, really outstanding. I'd like to begin also by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet and pay my respects to Elders past, present, and any First Nations people that are joining us today. So it really is an honour to join you today at the Anika Foundation fundraising lunch. This is my second occasion. As you've heard, the Foundation supports vital work on youth mental health research, awareness and education, and I'm sure like many, have a very strong personal interest in this. So I'm very proud to uphold the tradition of the Reserve Bank Governor speaking at this event to support an organisation that, as you can see from Saha, making a real difference. So my remarks today, I'm going to talk about the dual objectives of monetary policy. Price stability, which means maintaining low and stable inflation, and full employment, which I'll talk a little bit about in more detail later. What I'm going to do is explore how these aims have shaped the Monetary Policy Board's strategy in recent years. And as part of that, I'm going to reflect on the relationship between the labour market and inflation over time, and how conditions in the labour market have evolved to the present day. It's actually a pretty good time to revisit these subjects because 2 weeks ago we finalised a statement on the conduct of monetary policy. This is the agreement that we make with the government and the board on the key elements of the monetary policy framework. So, but before I do all of that, I want to just provide a bit of an update on recent monetary policy settings. So if you cast your mind back to 2022, you might recall that inflation was higher than it had been in decades. It peaked at 7.8% at the end of that year in 2022. And it was this rise in inflation that required a tightening in monetary policy over 2022 and 2023, with cash rate peaking, increasing from almost zero to 4.3% over that hiking period. Over the past couple of years, we have made meaningful progress in bringing inflation down. Higher interest rates have been working to bring aggregate supply and demand closer towards balance. We expect headline inflation in the June quarter to be in the lower half of our 2-3% target range, but that's headline, and that partly reflects ongoing effect of temporary cost of living relief. As that relief unwinds, we expect headline inflation to pick up to around the top of the band by the end of this year and into the first part of 2026. So to help look through some temporary factors like this, we also pay close attention to trimmed mean inflation or underlying inflation, and that's published quarterly. And that provides a good guide to underlying inflation trends. And I'm pleased to say this measure is also easing, but it's still a bit higher than headline inflation. It was at 2.9% in the March quarter, with year-ended trim mean under 3% for the first time since 2021. So that was very pleasing. We do expect trim mean inflation to fall a little further in the June quarter in year-ended terms. However, the monthly CPI indicator data, which are volatile, suggests the fall may be not quite as much as we forecast back in May. We still think it will show inflation declining slowly towards 2.5%, but we are looking for data to support this expectation. Now, encouragingly, as inflation slowed, the labour market's eased only gradually and the unemployment rate is relatively low. I'll have more to say on developments in the labour market later. Since February, we've reduced the cash rate by 50 basis points. The board continues to judge that a measured and gradual approach to monetary easing is appropriate. Global economic and policy developments have so far been largely in line with our May baseline forecasts, and the likelihood of a severe downside trade war appears to have diminished a bit. But there's still uncertainty and unpredictability in the global economy. The board's view is that monetary policy is well placed to respond decisively to adverse international developments if it's needed. Our long-standing strategy has been to bring inflation back to target while preserving as many of the gains in the labour market as possible. This approach has meant that interest rates in Australia did not rise as high as they did in some other economies, and so we may not need to lower them as much on the way down. We also know that Australians continue to feel cost of living pressures, with the average level of prices now notably higher than it was just a few years ago. And that's why we want to make sure that inflation remains low and stable from here on in. Low and stable inflation is good for households, it's good for jobs, it's good for communities, and it's good for the economy. Now, I want to step back from current policy settings and the inflationary episode of recent years to reflect on the framework that guides the board's decisions more generally. The RBA's monetary policy objectives are set out in legislation. Our overarching goal is to promote the economic prosperity and welfare of the Australian people, both now and into the future. For the board, this means setting monetary policy in a way that achieves both price stability and full employment. These goals are often referred to as our dual mandate, and they're long-standing objectives of the RBA. Over time, low and stable inflation and full employment go hand in hand. Low and stable inflation, or price stability, is a prerequisite for strong and sustainable employment growth because it creates favourable conditions for households and businesses to plan, invest and create jobs without having to worry about inflation. So our two objectives are complementary over the longer term. And even in the shorter term, the two objectives often go hand in hand. For example, when there are ups and downs in demand, inflation tends to rise as the labour market tightens, and vice versa. Inflation falls as the labour market loosens. So a monetary policy response that returns inflation to target will in time also move the labour market towards full employment. But sometimes there are developments that push inflation up at the same time as the way down on demand and therefore employment. This includes sharp increases in energy prices and supply disruptions that push up prices more broadly. And as I'll discuss in a moment, such negative supply shocks were part of the reason for the high inflation in recent years, though they weren't the only factor. So in the face of supply shocks that push up prices, we need to think about possible trade-offs. How do we balance our two goals in those circumstances? If the supply disruption is temporary and modest, monetary policy should mostly look through it. Raising interest rates makes little sense if inflation is expected to ease once the temporary supply disruptions are resolved. It would only weaken the job market. In contrast, when a supply shock is likely to have a longer-lasting effect on the economy and inflation, there may be stronger grounds for monetary policy to respond. Now, a key concern here is that the longer inflation remains high, the more households and businesses' expectations for future inflation could increase. This could in turn lead to second-round effects on inflation as households and businesses build higher expectations into their decisions. But if households and businesses instead maintain a high level of confidence that the board will do what is needed to return inflation to target, then inflationary shocks will have less effect on price and wage setting. That means we can look through adverse supply shocks to a greater extent, even those we think could last for some time. This highlights another important way in which our objectives are complementary, and it's something that I want to emphasise here. Having a strong track record of low and stable inflation puts us in the best possible position to support employment. It means there's less risk of inflation getting out of control, which allows inflation to be brought down with smaller increases in interest rates than otherwise. And this in turn keeps the labour market closer to full employment. That's why maintaining well-anchored inflation expectations is a key benefit of the inflation targeting frameworks. And as I'll return to in a moment, this is why it's also important that inflation returns sustainably to our target range. So how did this dual mandate shape our policy response to the post-pandemic rise in inflation? A few points. First, the starting point for our monetary policy settings mattered. These were very accommodative. The cash rate was effectively at zero. Second, the causes of the pickup in inflation were crucial. The initial pickup in inflation was partly driven by some of the supply factors I've mentioned. Temporary disruptions in global supply chains during the pandemic led to strong increases in goods prices, and then the war in the Ukraine caused a spike in global energy prices. But it was also clear that demand was part of the story. Accommodative fiscal and monetary policy settings in the pandemic period supported strong growth in demand for goods during lockdowns, and this demand strength interacted with supply constraints to amplify inflationary pressures. Then, as the lockdowns eased and the economy started to recover, demand for services also recovered very strongly. And as a result of all this, conditions in product markets and labour markets were very tight by mid-2022. It was clear we needed to increase interest rates to bring about a better balance between demand and supply, which would help to ease domestic price pressures. This need was reinforced by a concern that longer-run inflation expectations could increase. If this happened, it would add to inflationary pressure and would ultimately require a larger policy response and higher job losses. Although it was clear we needed to raise interest rates to slow demand growth, it was less clear how quickly demand pressures needed to ease, how persistent global shocks or their effects would be, and how much we could afford to look through those effects. The board could have chosen to match the more significant rate increases of some other central banks to bring inflation back to target more quickly, but this would have risked a sharper and more persistent increase in the unemployment rate. Instead, the board judged that a measured approach was consistent with its dual mandate. We increased the cash rate quickly at first, but we didn't go as high as some other central banks. We then held the cash rate for over a year, even as some other central banks started easing monetary policy. Throughout, we kept a close eye on long-term inflation expectations to ensure they remained anchored to the target. So this strategy was designed to rein in inflation while also preserving as many of the gains in the labour market as possible. This is an example of our dual mandate in practice. So how has this played out so far? Since the peak of inflation in 2022, headline inflation has declined by over 5 percentage points. And over the same period, there's been a relatively modest easing in labour market conditions. The unemployment rate's increased from around 3.5% in mid-2022 to 4.2% in the June quarter this year, and it remains low by historical standards. Crucially, the share of population in work has remained around record highs, and this, as you can see from this graph, is in contrast to many other advanced economies. The fact that unemployment has remained low and employment growth has remained strong is remarkable, and I'd have to say really, really welcome. And it's striking that the increase in the unemployment rate has been small compared with the large decline in inflation. And you can see from this graph that this is especially true when you compare it with previous periods of disinflation in Australia. So why is this? Well, part of the answer is what I talked about earlier. It's the supply-driven increases turned out to be temporary, and even if they flowed through to the economy over a long period of time. And as these supply disruptions eventually subsided and oil prices declined, price pressures eased. And as I also mentioned earlier, the board were very alert to the risk that inflation expectations could increase. Crucially, this didn't happen. Instead, households and businesses continued to believe that inflation would return to the target range. This limited any second-round effects on inflation, which allowed inflation to fall without a sharp rise in the unemployment rate. And this demonstrates the point I made earlier about how two objectives can be complementary. A history of low and stable inflation and the resulting public confidence in the inflation target enabled the board to adopt the strategy that protected the labour market as much as possible while still ensuring inflation came down. I've already highlighted the comparatively modest increase in the unemployment rate over the past few years from very low level, and that the overall employment has continued growing. The rate of layoffs has increased only a little, and it remains remarkably low by historical standards, as you can see from this graph. The share of workers who are long-term unemployed also remains low. These are good outcomes because job losses are a really painful way for the labour market to adjust to tighter monetary policy. Losing a job can be one of the most stressful events in someone's life, and it can have far-reaching implications for families and communities. So while the unemployment rate has risen since its trough in 2022, including an uptick in the month of June, there has been significant jobs growth in aggregate. So instead, what we've observed is the labour market has adjusted in some other less disruptive ways. First, job vacancies have declined from a very high level as firms have slowed hiring activity. Second, the average number of hours worked that people are working has declined. This follows a period when hours had increased sharply due to very strong demand for workers. Having your hours cut is tough, but it's often preferable to losing a job altogether. And it's also worth noting that some of this decline in hours has been voluntary, especially over the past year or so. Third, there's been a decline in the share of workers voluntarily leaving their jobs, otherwise called the quits rate. This suggests that there could be less need for firms to compete and attract and retain workers, implying less upward pressure on wages growth than otherwise. So in summary, the gradual easing in labour market conditions has so far been most evident in fewer jobs vacancies, reductions in hours worked, and declining rates of voluntary job switching. These shifts, as I mentioned, aren't without their challenges, but they all tend to be less disruptive than outright job losses. I actually should note at this point too that the RBA can't wave a magic wand and control how adjustments in the labour market play out. Interest rates don't work that way, they're too blunt. And I'm not here to claim credit for the fact that the adjustment has so far taken place in a less costly way. But by the same token, because the labour market can adjust in different ways, we don't target any one adjustment mechanism, such as we don't set a number of job losses that we might need to see supply and demand come back into balance. Indeed, as I said, there's actually been substantial job gains over this period. So bringing the labour market story up to date, our overall assessment at the time of the most recent forecast in May was that there was still some tightness in the labour market and we expected it to ease a little over the remainder of this year. A broad range of indicators underpinned this assessment, and in many ways, not much has changed since May. Firms still report significant difficulties finding labour, even if this constraint has eased somewhat. The ratio of vacancies to unemployed people remains high. At the same time, unit labour costs have been increasing strongly. In May, we also highlighted the possibility that labour market conditions could be less tight than we thought. As I noted earlier, the low rate of job switching may imply less upward pressure on wage growth than otherwise. And the quarterly rate of underlying inflation has recently been around a pace that would be consistent with 2.5% in annual terms. For that reason, our May forecast for wages growth and inflation incorporated some downward judgment to reflect the possibility that there is more capacity in the labour market and the economy more broadly than would be suggested by our usual assessment. Last week, of course, brought us the latest labour market data, and that confirmed that the unemployment rate increased in the June quarter. I'd have to say some of the coverage of the latest data suggested this was a shock, but the outcome for the June quarter was in line with the forecast we released in May. That on its own suggests that the labour market moved a little further towards balance as we were anticipating. While the June monthly data showed a noticeable pickup in the unemployment rate, other measures, such as the vacancy rate, have been stable lately. More broadly, leading indicators are not pointing to further significant increases in the unemployment rate in the near term. Nevertheless, the risks we highlighted in May remain. As always, there's uncertainty about how labour market conditions stand relative to full employment, and we will continue to closely monitor incoming labour market data. Our August statement on monetary policy will provide a full updated assessment of labour market conditions and the outlook, and that comes out in about 3 weeks. So to conclude, our goals of low and stable inflation and full employment are closely linked and generally reinforce one another. A critical feature of the recent high inflation period is that longer-term inflation expectations remain anchored. This has enabled the Board's monetary policy strategy of bringing inflation down in a relatively gradual way so as to limit the easing in labour market conditions. Much of the rebalancing in demand and supply in the labour market that has occurred in recent years has been reflected in declines in job vacancies, hours worked, and voluntary job switching. There are many ways the labour market can adjust. The RBA doesn't target a specific outcome, like a certain unemployment rate or a number of job losses to reach full employment. Monetary policy can't control how the adjustment happens. But if it can occur while keeping employment strong or even growing, that's a great outcome for workers, families, communities and the economy. In the end, the best way to promote the economic welfare of Australians is by achieving low and stable inflation alongside full employment, and that's what the Board's constantly striving for. So thank you, and I look forward to taking your questions.
As Michelle said, she's kindly going to take some questions. We have a microphone on the left for non-media and a microphone on the right for media. I'm going to take the first couple of questions from non-media guests and then I'll alternate. So I can see, I think that's Tapas. I've put on my glasses but I'm still struggling to see. From National Australia Bank, go ahead.
Hi, Bessa. Indeed, it is Tapas Strickland here. And if you don't know my voice, you would have heard me on the NAB Morning Call. I recommend you subscribe if you don't already. In terms of your speech, Governor Bullock, I really loved the speech. The description of the labour market, I think, is still relatively tight. But there is a bit of dichotomy with below-trend growth, and I was just wondering if you could illuminate us in terms of the Board's feelings or even your own personal feelings about the trends in productivity and what monetary policy implications that may come from that.
Sorry, the last part of the question, what monetary policy...
Implications that may come from that.
Oh, that, okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tapas. And yes, I do subscribe, actually. I think it's probably no surprise for me to say that productivity over the last few years has not grown, and certainly not grown as much as our assumptions. We have a productivity assumption in all of our forecasts, and it's fair to say that over the last few years we've been assuming around about a 1% growth in productivity, and it just hasn't eventuated. So in the lead up to the August SMP, we're going to be looking quite heavily at that assumption and thinking about whether or not it's appropriate. What it means for monetary policy isn't necessarily straightforward. If we have been observing slow growth in demand, and a lot of people have pointed to that as demonstrating that monetary policy is perhaps too restrictive. But the other possibility is that what it is reflecting is just really slow growth in supply. And the economy can't grow as fast if it really is the fact, as it seems to be, that productivity is not growing, then demand just can't grow because the supply side of the economy can't grow. So the implications for monetary policy depend very much on that gap between supply and demand. And so one of the things I think we'll be thinking about in our August forecast round is whether or not the gap is narrowing. If we do have to adjust our productivity assumptions, it mightn't mean anything much for inflation because it might just be reflecting the fact that demand and supply have both been going quite slowly over time.
Thank you, Governor Bullock. And if you'd like to appear on the NAB Morning Call podcast, please let me know. Thank you.
Jonathan.
Hi, Jonathan Kearns from Challenger. Governor, thank you for your speech. One of the concepts that is really important in that dual mandate is the NAIRU, so that level of unemployment that we economists get very excited about, that sort of is the balance where inflation's neither increasing or decreasing. The bank's estimates have put that at being probably somewhere around 4.5%. A lot of private economists have said, you know, it might be as low as 4%. But that difference is probably even small relative to, from prior to the pandemic, it was probably more around 5.5%. So there has been that decline over that time period. We can't point to any labour market policy changes that have pushed that. Rather, it seems to have been keeping people employed manages to get a lower level of the NAIRU. And so in that sense, the policies through the pandemic in Australia that kept people employed have perhaps contributed that. So then bringing to the other side of things with productivity, and you're going to the productivity roundtable obviously in a few weeks' time, the one country in the world that has high productivity is America, and they actually point to changes in job matching, people through the pandemic losing their job, going to a new higher productivity job as being the one that is driving that high productivity. So as a society, you mentioned that the Reserve Bank Board just takes productivity and the NAIRU is given, but as a society, how do you think we think about that balance, that by keeping more people employed, we might actually end up having lower productivity growth? And how might you think about that discussion at the productivity roundtable in a few weeks?
Big question, and I'm not sure I can answer it in short space, but a couple of comments. I actually asked Jay Powell why so much growth in productivity and in the US relative to every other country that's got exactly the same issue as we have with growth in labour productivity. And he put it down to just much more dynamism in the labour market. It might be due to some of those pandemic factors you spoke about, but I think much more broadly, labour market in the US possibly is a little more dynamic generally. We released a bulletin today in which we've got an article in there which is looking at the question of whether when the labour market was really tight, we bought in a lot of people from the labour market that hadn't been employed before, possibly had less skills, and it was asking the question whether or not that was a reason why we had low productivity growth. And the article actually doesn't find that that is an impact, and in fact it suggests it helped productivity. So I think that's suggestive of the fact that the proposition you are putting, which is that if you can generate a strong enough economy to draw more people in, ultimately that will probably be good, not only for the NAIRU, although, you know, we don't rely solely on the NAIRU, and there's a big debate about that. But I think it does bode well for productivity. If we can bring people in and train them, ultimately I think that probably does bode well for productivity, rather than having a high unemployment rate and a lot of people possibly who have something to contribute being kept out of the labour market. So that's probably a short answer to what is probably a very large question, but I hope it gives some insight.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. I'll just ask that nobody join any more question queues, because the queues are quite long and I'm not sure if we're going to get through all of them.
I think you should ask the school students.
Yes, and I was just I think Joe won't mind, but can we also have the student, that's the female at the back, just come to the front. I'll get the two students to ask the questions and then I'll alternate, but I do ask that both the media and non-media line, except for the students, keep the questions very short.
Good afternoon, Governor. Taj Gupta, Shaw School. I shall say thanks again for a really great speech, really helpful for me and the other guys. We've got our macro policy essay tomorrow, so let's hope we can get something good out of this. I was wondering, like, in the face of really big domestic uncertainty regarding productivity growth, what do you see the role of monetary policy moving forward to be? Is it just going to be shifting back towards a neutral rate of interest and possibly looking at some further expansionary stances from there? And do you think as well there's room for possible collaboration with fiscal policy to expand the effectiveness in reducing issues, particularly with the growth in, say, the care economy and the services sector, in trying to ameliorate the low productivity that we've seen, which would be really great for getting economic growth back to the target range?
Okay. Excellent question. Thank you. So in terms of monetary policy and productivity, there's nothing specific monetary policy can do. But personally, if monetary policy can deliver low and stable inflation and full employment, that is the best thing you can do for encouraging productivity. Because if workers and businesses don't have to be worrying about inflation, they can be thinking about ways to improve their productivity, ways they can work better, and they're not worried about those sorts of things. So I think there is a role for monetary policy in providing a stable macroeconomic environment. In terms of fiscal policy and monetary policy, obviously they are independent. The government has a lot it has to do with fiscal policy. It has to meet demands for aged care, health, education. It needs to meet demands for infrastructure. It needs to do that in a way that also helps the economy maintain low and stable inflation. So that's the way monetary policy and fiscal policy can work together. We can both do our own thing. But as I said, fiscal policy does have much broader responsibilities, and it needs to try and do that in a way that contributes to the stability of the economy as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And if you'd be interested, we've got a productivity panel at the end of Term 3 in about September. So if you'd like to join us, please speak to my teacher. Thank
you. Hi, I'm Isabel Roth-Mazzocchi from Skeggs, and I don't have a very fancy or long question. But I was just wondering, why did the labour markets respond so well recently as opposed to the much more worse and possible outcomes?
Yeah, it's. I think it's partly. I probably would say this, wouldn't I? I think it's partly that we tried to be careful in raising interest rates. We knew we had to raise them.
Yeah.
They were very accommodative. We knew we had to raise them first to get rid of the accommodation in monetary policy, and then get it restrictive. But we took a deliberate decision not to raise them as high as some other countries did, and some other countries did raise them much higher, and countries like Canada and New Zealand experienced much higher unemployment rates. Canada's now is over 6, I think. Mm. So it was a deliberate strategy and in slowing the economy to try and make sure that we didn't lose the gains we hadn't. And as we've said, we've kept employment growing. The unemployment rate has risen a bit. It's because there's been more people looking for work than there were jobs created, but employment has still been growing.
Yep.
So I think that's probably the gist of the app.
Thank you so much.
We'll go to the media over here.
Good afternoon, Governor. Tom Dusevic from The Australian. In recent times, we've seen Jay Powell put under extraordinary pressure by the US president, administration officials. Do you think this is just Trump theatre, or do you think there could be some real consequences for the financial system and central bank independence?
I would say, wouldn't I, that I think central bank independence is very important. Certainly, what's going on in the United States is challenging that, but I'd have to say at the moment that the Fed is doing what it's supposed to be doing, which is focusing on the economy, the employment. They are not getting drawn into the debate. And so at this stage, I would say that they're preserving their independence by acting in the way they think is appropriate. I can't speak for what goes through Mr. Trump's mind. I'm not sure anyone can. But obviously, I think, as we all know, Jay Powell's term is coming to an end, so it's going to be interesting to see what happens from here. But I would say that generally, the general principle around the world of central bank independence still remains a very firm a guiding light.
Thanks, Governor.
Another one.
Michael Yander from the ABC. Thanks, Governor. You said the most recent employment data didn't come as a shock to the Reserve Bank, and it merely confirmed the trajectory in the bank's forecasts. But one of the reasons why the majority on the board elected to hold interest rates at your most recent meeting was a degree of uncertainty about how the economy was evolving. Do you think the board's decision may have been different had it had access to that unemployment data ahead of the last meeting?
No, I don't believe so, Michael. I think the number, the monthly numbers pop up and down. In fact, if you go back a year, I think in July 24, the monthly number popped up from 4.0 to 4.2, and everyone went, and then it settled around 4.1 for a bit. So the monthly numbers jump around. Our quarterly forecast was for the unemployment rate to drift up to 4.2 in the June quarter. It's pretty much on mark. So we don't think that the month, you know, you've got to take a little bit of signal from monthly numbers, but I wouldn't overinterpret every single monthly number. And as I said, pretty much in line with our forecasts at this stage.
We'll take another one from the media and then we'll go over there.
Hi, Governor. It's Jessica McSweeney here from the Sydney Morning Herald. My question is, you've made a point in the speech about how unemployment averaged 4.2% in the June quarter, but unemployment has to two decimal points increased for four consecutive months, while the employment to population ratio has been easing since the start of the year. Is there a danger the jobs market could deteriorate more quickly than the bank anticipates?
So that's one of the risks we highlight in our forecast. We do highlight that that's a possibility, but the forward-looking indicators, including vacancies, including layoff rates, including the information we're getting from liaison, aren't suggesting that anything's falling off a cliff anytime soon. So we are conscious. The unemployment rate has been drifting up, as I said, but we had been expecting that, and I wouldn't draw too much from second decimal points.
Can we also just make it quick, please, because there's lots of questions. Over here.
My name's Stephen Scott from Veritas Securities. Having unwittingly paid $5.11 for my cup of coffee up the front, did I participate in some sort of a digital event, digital sort of inflation that I didn't anticipate? In other words, do you think digital money is inherently inflationary, or do you have a different view of that? Thank you.
That's an interesting question. So I actually don't really know. I wouldn't say so. Does it make it easier to tap your card and not think about how much you're spending? Quite possibly. Certainly I've heard people say that one good way of budgeting is to use cash for everything. But I wouldn't say digital money in and of itself is inherently inflationary, but because you've only got as much money as you've got.
Over here.
Thanks for the speech, Governor. Luca Itimani from The Guardian. A month ago, markets had a July rate cut baked in. And then the meeting minutes released this week indicate the board barely gave a second thought to surprising markets. Should markets be more prepared in coming months for the RBA to be a bit unpredictable?
I wouldn't say. So what the minutes, I think, hopefully pointed out was the reasons why we decided to hold, and that surprising the markets was neither a reason for doing it or not for doing it. It was an observation of the board that the markets were expecting something else. I wouldn't say that our job is to be unpredictable. Our job is to basically do what we think, the board thinks, is the right thing to do for the economy, and the markets will interpret their own data, the data in a certain way, and they interpreted slightly differently than we did at the time. So I wouldn't say we're trying to be unpredictable, and I wouldn't say that we're looking to be unpredictable in the future. We're just looking to do what we think is the right thing.
Next, Ed.
Hi, Governor. Edward Boyd from Sky News. This week, the Bureau of Statistics put out an interesting announcement. They are going to be publishing a complete monthly snapshot of inflation from November, which is going to prevent that high reliance on the quarterly CPI numbers. That'll be a thing of the past. So if that had come out this month, would you have been able to cut interest rates?
Well, first of all, can I say, yay, ABS. Very, very happy. It'll bring us into line with most other advanced economies now with a monthly CPI. It wouldn't have had implications, I don't think, necessarily for the current decision. I just would caution, though, that we've only got data for some items since April 24, so the new monthly series is still going to be transitional. The ABS are still going to be producing the quarterly data, which has a very long history of seasonal adjustment and predictability to it. So they're still going to be producing that, and we're still going to be looking at that. So we're not doing an immediate switch from off with the quarterly and on with the monthly. We're going to be looking at both. And there's going to be a learning experience as we learn how to interpret the monthly data. And as we get more and the seasonal adjustments get better, it will be better. Having said that, it'll be great. I've made a number of points in the past that it's very difficult to interpret momentum in inflation when you only have four readings a year. This is going to be much more helpful for us.
Over here.
Jonathan Rochford from Narrow Road Capital. Over the last decade, headline CPI has averaged 2.78% per annum, and the RBA cash rate has averaged 1.84% per annum. After including tax rates, real returns for low-risk investments have been substantially below zero. The consequence of this subsidisation of borrowers includes higher debt levels, lower savings, more speculative investment, greater financial instability and higher house prices. All of these are negative for productivity and are negative for the economic prosperity and welfare of Australians in the long term. Does any of this sort of analysis form part of the RBA's decisions on the cash rate?
So the Reserve Bank's mandate is inflation and full employment. And what you've alluded to is asset price inflation. The sense in which asset price inflation might be relevant to monetary policy is if it has implications for financial stability. And as you know, we do quite a lot of work on financial stability. We release a half-yearly report on financial stability. The bottom line, though, is that it's very difficult for a central bank to target asset prices. We do have to remain focused on inflation and unemployment. Asset price inflation, to the extent, and the thing most people focus on in terms of asset price inflation is housing price inflation. And that's not something we can do anything about. To the extent that it is about rising debt levels and that's driving it, then that's a matter that's something that the Provincial Regulation Authority can deal with in its macroprudential measures. And to the extent that it's due to a shortage of housing, it's up to governments to do something about. So I push back on the idea that somehow the Reserve Bank needs to take into account asset price inflation in setting monetary policy.
Look, we'll take the last question from the left. I'm really sorry to the journos that missed out, but we just won't be able to finish the event in time if we keep everyone waiting.
Andrew Boak from Goldman Sachs. First of all, Governor, congratulations on successfully implementing so many aspects of the RBA review. Obviously, been a big couple of years for you, a lot on your plate. My question relates to one of the key recommendations from the review. Since April in the statement on the conduct of monetary policy, it's been sort of a requirement that RBA board members deliver public addresses. And, you know, we're getting on for August now. We haven't had too many of those. So my question is twofold, I guess. Firstly, when do you think we might hear from some of the RBA board members publicly beyond yourself and your deputy? And secondly, given you're rightly concerned about front-running RBA board decisions with commentary, should we expect RBA board members to brief the media? Is that happening?
So we are in the process of implementing that recommendation. It's, I think the words are speeches or public appearances. What we're in the process of doing with the board is working through what the various options for speeches and public appearances might look like, what the board members might do at those sorts of speeches and public appearances. Again, individual board members are in the same situation as I am. They are not going to be able to speak for what the board might do. They certainly will, I think, be able to explain the board's current decision, but they're not going to be able to front run just as I can't. As you saw from the last meeting, 6 voted in favour of hold, 3 voted to lower, and there was active debate, but the board decision was a majority decision, which ultimately is the one that that was made. So it's very, you can't go out ahead of time and say you definitely know what the decision is going to be.
Thank you.
Well done. Thanks. Thank you for being so generous with the Q&A. I'm sorry some people did miss out asking questions. But it is important that we finish the event on time, as we promised. Look, thank you.